Next week, Nirvana will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The band's former members, Dave Grohl and Chris Novoselic, will be there. But of course, their friend and bandmate, Kurt Cobain, will not. He killed himself, as we know, on April 5th, 1994. That's 20 years ago this weekend. Journalist Charles Cross covered Cobain for the Seattle magazine The Rocket, which was the first publication to put Nirvana on its cover. He later wrote Heavier Than Heaven, the biography of Kurt Cobain, and he has a new book out now to mark this anniversary. It's called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Charles Cross joins us from KUOW in Seattle. Charles, welcome.
Thank you.
Why did you feel it was necessary to write a second book about Kurt Cobain?
Well, Heavier Than Heaven is a straight-on biography where it's written in the third person and I do not insert myself as a narrator at all. That book ends essentially with Kurt's death in 1994, and a lot has happened since he has died. And his impact on music and on culture we can see with a much wider lens now. I felt like there were certain things that I kind of wanted to get off my chest, and I wanted to tell the story in a first-person way. And so this book is kind of more like a conversation with me. It's some of the topics that I feel are very important about Kurt's legacy: addiction, suicide, music, fashion, and how he changed the perception of Seattle. I think I guess felt impassioned that I somehow had more to say.
And we want to talk about all of those things. But first of all, let's get to his musical impact. What do you think it has been 20 years now after his death?
Well, it's truly an extraordinary impact. I think it's greater than anyone would have imagined 20 years ago. To some degree, that's affected by technological change. Nirvana's impact, both in terms of the sales of their album, somewhere around 35 million albums sold. We haven't seen a rock group have that kind of huge mass cultural impact since Kurt died, partially because there hasn't been someone else to follow them. I think their legacy has been somewhat increased. But I also think that their greatest legacy is simply those songs. Those songs have such meaning to so many people. And when we talk about Kurt and why he mattered, that is by far and away the reason that he mattered, is that that body of songs that he created and wrote still speak to listeners today, both listeners that heard it in the 90s and people that are just discovering it now. That is an incredible body of work, and it's the reason that we still talk about him.
And people that are in a completely different genre. I'm thinking of Jay-Z and Justin Timberlake, who reference Cobain's death and adapt the lyrics from Smells Like Teen Spirit in their song Holy Grail. Let's listen to that. Did that surprise you that Jay-Z and Justin Timberlake referenced Kurt Cobain like that?
Well, in some ways, it didn't surprise me. In this book, I actually chronicle the fact that there are 55 hip-hop artists who have sampled Nirvana. I think what did surprise me was that in this year's Grammy Awards, Kurt Cobain, because of that Jay-Z song, was nominated in the Best Rap category. Then in the ultimate irony, Kurt Cobain loses that category to Macklemore, another great Seattle up-and-coming artist. So that is so wild, you just couldn't have made that up in, you know, your wildest kind of dream. But, you know, Kurt had a big impact on a lot of people who grew up in that era. And just because an artist is a hip-hop artist or a rap artist, that doesn't mean that the music didn't mean something to them.
You write that Kurt had both everything and nothing to do with the term grunge, which we associate with these bands that came out of the Pacific Northwest. What do you mean by that?
He hated the word grunge, and pretty much everyone in Seattle hated the word grunge. And the reason was is that grunge was kind of a journalistic laziness to describe all the music that came out of here. And if we just take Nirvana, for example, and we compare some of their music to Pearl Jam, there's so many differences. And though there are squealing guitars here and there, they aren't even really playing exactly the same genre of music. Yet, to everybody in the world, suddenly it all became grunge. And then you throw in Alice in Chains and Soundgarden, who had both more metal influences. it just was not really a fair term to describe everyone from our region as grunge. So Kurt hated it, musicians hated it, but to some degree it couldn't be stopped. It was the name that defined that music, it defined that generation, and it went on crazily to also even define fashion and a number of other things. Grunge has had a life in fashion that goes far beyond the life it has had in music.
Okay, let's talk about Kurt Cobain's impact on fashion. This is not something that I thought much about before reading your book, but he really was a fashion statement in the way that he dressed, and there are certain things about what he did that not only made a big splash back then, but are still big in the fashion world today.
Well, it's truly amazing because there has never been a fashion icon who put so little effort into their appearance and yet sold so many clothes at such a high price tag later on in his life. So Kurt wore flannel shirts, which he bought from Army-Navy stores for $5 or from thrift shops. And the reason he wore that is that's what people in Aberdeen and the Pacific Northwest wear because it's freezing for a lot of the year. And those designs eventually were co-opted by some of the hottest, you know, fashion designers, including Marc Jacobs, and were touted on fashion runways at $400 a pop. And they still are. Even this last year, there were a couple fashion designers who debuted what they called their grunge collection. So what's really remarkable is that grunge to most people in music means a certain time. It means the 90s. But in fashion today, if you went to Nordstrom.com and typed the word in grunge, you would find a half dozen outfits or styles that are described as grunge with current fashions.
And how do you think Kurt Cobain would feel about that?
He would think that'd be the craziest thing that ever possibly could have happened. I mean, Kurt wore his jeans till they had holes in them and were all worn out because he couldn't afford new jeans. And now that exact same look, which we now call distressed denim, i.e. trashed, often sells for a great premium over jeans that are actually new and look good.
We're speaking with Charles Cross. His new book is Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. Cobain died 20 years ago this weekend. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And let's get back to our conversation about the legacy of Kurt Cobain, who died 20 years ago this weekend. The leader of the rock band Nirvana killed himself on April 5th, 1994, and when the news came out, there was shock in his hometown of Aberdeen, Washington.
It's just too bad. I knew him for quite a long time. He was one of my friends. He lived right up by me.
Well, we've been speaking with journalist Charles Cross, who covered Nirvana from the beginning for the Seattle magazine The Rocket. His new book is called Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. And he's with us from KUOW in Seattle. Charles, Kurt Cobain sang about his hometown, Aberdeen, in the song Something in the Way. Let's listen to some of that.
Underneath the bridge, top is sprung a leak, and the animals I've trapped all become my pets, and I'm living off of grass. Drippings from the ceiling. It's okay to eat fish, 'cause they don't have any feelings. Something in the way.
Charles Cross, how is Kurt Cobain remembered in Aberdeen?
Well, it's funny you would play that song because the bridge that that song is ostensibly placed at, where Kurt, you know, sort of is metaphorically going in that song, is still there. And that is one of the only things in Aberdeen that has been done to sort of honor Kurt. An individual, kind of this old guy near there, took it upon himself, and he took a bulldozer and created a park on his own because the city of Aberdeen had done nothing to honor Kurt. And that park is right next to that bridge. The city of Aberdeen eventually took over maintenance of the park, so they have officially sort of endorsed it, and it's called the Kurt Cobain Riverfront Park. And if you went there right now, you would see a steady stream of fans from all around the world who visit Aberdeen and want to see this one little piece of Kurt. But Aberdeen has had a difficult time figuring out how to honor its most famous sons. Some of the political entities there have felt that doing anything to honor Kurt would somehow be endorsing drug use, which I think is just absolutely crazy, because truly we talk about Kurt because of the music he created, not because of any personal foibles he had. But it does seem like it's finally starting to shift 20 years after his death.
Although we do need to talk about the fact that he did commit suicide, and that has become a major part of his legacy. A few days after his body was found, there was a memorial vigil in Seattle. His widow, Courtney Love, recorded a message for his fans that was played during that vigil. Here she is reading from Cobain's suicide note.
Sometimes I feel as I should have a punched-in time clock before I walk out on stage. I've tried everything within my power to appreciate it, and I do. God, believe me, I do, but it's not enough.
Charles Cross, you say that that event turned into brilliant public health policy. Why?
And rarely is it that the words Courtney Love and brilliant public health policy appear anywhere near each other. But in some strange way, that outpouring of emotion that you heard from Courtney and that you also felt in the crowd, and I was among the 10,000 there, there was such anger. It took away the romanticism of suicide. When Marilyn Monroe had died earlier with pills, it had sort of been romanticized by the press. But because Kurt's choice of suicide was so violent, so final, and frankly, because we got to actually hear his words, and everyone in the crowd at one point screamed a giant F you to Kurt. Courtney asked everyone to do that. There was this kind of collective unconscious primal scream that gave us a chance to kind of go through that emotion. And it took away that kind of English mysticism, romanticism of suicide. We got to see the face and hear the words of a person that had lost her husband. And I think it changed the way people thought about his suicide.
You think it kept people from committing suicide, other people?
Well, shockingly, the theory had always been that Kurt's death had, you know, set off a number of copycat suicides. For this book, the main new research that I was able to kind of break was that I interviewed some of the people who actually study suicide. And they extensively researched Kurt's suicide, both in the United States and in Australia. And they looked at suicide rates and found that they either stayed even or went down slightly in the wake of Kurt's death. Unfortunately, that statistic has eked up over time, and suicide remains an epidemic throughout the world and certainly in the United States. But Kurt Cobain's death, in some weird way that almost seems impossible to imagine, may have actually stopped some people from committing suicide more than what we thought, that it would send a wave of copycat suicides.
Talking about him in a way in the abstract here, you, of course, knew him. You were a fan. What impact did he have, or does he continue to have, on you personally?
Well, the music certainly impacted me. It was part of my life. The magazine that I edited, The Rocket, Kurt was also our customer. He advertised in The Rocket several times looking for drummers. So when we lost him, we really felt like we lost part of Seattle's soul, frankly. You know, Kurt Cobain is owned by the world, but Seattle, Even though he only lived here for 18 months of his life, ironically, we feel that he is ours and we are his to some degree. These songs are so much the fabric of my life, and I think so much the fabric of every music fan in Seattle's life, that when we talk about his legacy, it's also to some degree our legacy, our youths. It was the one time where it suddenly felt to everybody here that the world could go on its end. I mean, as you had introduced me, we're talking in the offices of KUOW in Seattle. In the basement of this building, Nirvana played. So I'm 50 feet away from where this band played one of their very first Seattle gigs. So it really is a huge part of Seattle's historical legacy and part of our culture.
By the way, Michael Stipe of REM is inducting Nirvana into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame next week. You say there couldn't be a more appropriate choice for that role.
Absolutely. I mean, Michael and Kurt were friends, and towards the end of his life, Kurt was talking about sort of retreating and going to work with Michael. And Stipe says he sent Kurt a plane ticket, and Kurt did not use that plane ticket. So I think they were sort of kinship between the two. They were sort of both people who were underdogs and had come up from independent rock to, you know, be spokespeople of their generation. So Michael's a very smart guy, and I'm sure his words are going to be very eloquent, and I can't wait to hear them.
Charles Cross is the author of Here We Are Now, The Lasting Impact of Kurt Cobain. You can read an excerpt of the book at hereandnow.org. Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're listening in Seattle on KUOW or around the country for that matter, let us know what Kurt Cobain meant to you, if anything. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art. New shows on view now by artists William Kentridge and Nick Cave, ICABoston.org.